Welcome to our panel session on Chazal. Kodem Kol, I really want to give a real thanks, real gratitude to Stuart and Carol Lesser for sponsoring this program and for helping to support Talmud Torah. Really appreciative of that. The structure here is going to be that each of the speakers will speak for a maximum of 5 to 10 minutes and briefly outline some ideas on this topic, and then I will ask some questions, and then we'll throw it open to the floor, and we'll begin with Rabbi Angel.
Okay, good afternoon. When the topic was first sent over by Rabbi Kelman, I wrote back to him right away saying, I don't know how I'm going to be able to talk for as long as 5 minutes, let alone 10. And I gave a one-sentence answer to the question, which the question on the panel is officially, when are we able to dispute what Chazal say, in what context? So let me give you the one sentence, and then I'll give you the five-minute background to the one sentence, and I'll turn it over to my learned colleagues who will be able to give a more fine-tuned description as they see it. The short answer is almost always, right? When it comes to the realm of Agadah, meaning non-binding halakhic matters, our parshanim have always reserved the right to disagree with just about any agadic teaching that Chazal say, on the level of pshat. So that's on that realm. On the halakhic realm, they're not willing to dispute, for the most part, halakha lema'aseh, meaning they won't paskin against the way Chazal have ruled, if they've ruled, but some of them reserve a right to dispute on the level of pshat, is there an independent halakhic meaning of a text, even if we follow a binding halakha lema'aseh that Chazal paskin? That's the one sentence, or two sentence, I guess, answer to how I would have addressed the question just in terms of the history of parshanut. If I have to give a five-minute background to why that sentence is the sentence that our parshanim follow, I would do something along the lines of trying to describe, well, how do we know anything? So in general, there's two ways that we can know stuff. One is God said so. And two is because we figured it out with our own limited minds, right? So in other words, the way that Parshanim work is anything that's in Tanakh, since God said so, whether explicitly or through inspiration, however you understand the various levels of Tanakh, you're not allowed to disagree with Tanakh on the standard playing field of traditional biblical interpretation. You can disagree with what does this pasuk mean. We do that all the time. But once we can all agree that this is what a pasuk means, you will not, on average, dispute its meaning in classical parshanut. Okay, then we have two other categories of how we might know something, and that is stuff that's not written in Tanakh, but we can know it from another way. One is what we call halakha l'Moshe mi-Sinai. If God revealed something to Moshe orally, but it's not written in the Torah, well, God still said it, even though it's not written in the Torah. So it's just as true as something that is written in the Torah. And then we have another element, which is not revelation, and that is eyewitness testimony, what we would call colloquially a misorah. It doesn't mean everything that my Rebbe taught me. Misorah is a very limited meaning in this context. For example, there was a Nishak Hushit, who I mentioned earlier today, that Miriam and Aaron had some problem with some Cushite woman that Moshe Rabbeinu was married to. Who was this woman? So there's two possibilities. One is Tziporah, and one is somebody else. Right, those are the two options that we have out there. And our Mifarshim debate, which one of those two options is correct? Meaning, if we were to take a time machine back, would we find, and we landed in the room with the Yishak Hushit and Tziporah, how many people would be in the room? So if you think that Tziporah and Yishak Hushit are the same person, then how many people are in the room? Two. Tziporah, who is the Yishak Hushit, and you, because you just showed up in a time machine. So two people are in the room, right? And if you think that they are different people, well, then you have the Tziporah and Yishak Hushit. Moshe has two different wives. And you, because you're also in the time machine, so three. Okay. So I don't know the answer to this question in a nutshell, even though I have my guess of which of those theories is correct. But Yehoshua ben Nun knew the answer to that question. Why? Not because he studied the Torah. He didn't need to. He was there. So whatever you might derive from the psukim, Yehoshua ben Nun might have, in theory, passed on to his students, who passed on to their students, the identity of this Yishak Hushit. When he taught the Torah to his students, he would know exactly which of those two options is correct because he was there. So how does that play out with Chazal? Chazal have two ways of knowing anything. One is they figured it out from reading the text, and the other one is that they're privy to some received tradition. If they're figuring it out, well, then our Mifarshim have the right to debate them because they're figuring it out too. There's no superior preference to Chazal. But if Chazal are privy to a tradition, well, then that's just right. They have privileged information that later Mifarshim don't have. So how does that play out in the realm of Halakha and Agadah? In Halakha, Chazal might have figured something out, or they might have a tradition. We're not sure which one, almost ever. So what do? We accept their psak as authoritative, on average. There are exceptions to this in debates, but the fundamental view that most Mifarshim subscribe to most of the time is that we've accepted the psak Halakha of Chazal as binding, either because God said so, because it's a tradition, or because we've accepted their authority because we're not sure. And therefore, we defer as a matter of course, just as the Amoraim defer to the Tanaim. So that's why Chazal become binding in the realm of Halakha, even if there exists an independent pshat reading of a given pasuk here or there. In the realm of Agadah, we don't have that binding system of authority. So what our Mifarshim do is, Chazal might mean themselves literally, or they might mean themselves figuratively. Very often they speak in figurative language in Agadah, in which case we're not even disagreeing with them. We're simply saying they didn't mean their words as literal. And we think that the literal reading is this. A good example of this is a midrash that says, Yaakov Avinu lo meid. Yaakov did not die. So the Talmud asks, what are you talking about? Of course he died. You don't usually eulogize, mummify, and bury somebody who is alive. And that's what they did to Yaakov Avinu. Odds are good he died. What is your issue? It's a mikra nidoresh. I'm Chazal, I'm not Rashbam. I'm darshaning a pasuk to teach some other lesson, and you could debate even what that other lesson is. So from that vantage point, that midrash, if you say Yaakov died, you're not disagreeing with the Gemara. You're simply operating on a different level of interpretation, what Mifarshim will refer to as, we're speaking Derech HaPshat, and they're speaking Derech HaDrash. But even when Chazal intend their words literally, such as all those midrashim that identify the Isha Kushit as Tzipora, Mifarshim reserve the right to disagree, as long as it's not a Misorah, as long as it's not an oral tradition received from Yehoshua ben Nun. So the way that works out in practice is they might say, I think it's a different person, like what Rashbam does. But im kabbalah hi nikabel, if Chazal in fact have an oral received tradition, that's privileged information, we have to defer to that. So on the playing field, on a practical level, Mifarshim almost always reserve the right to disagree with Chazal because they don't know when there is privileged information in store. And they simply have that as a caveat in case there is an oral tradition beyond the text evidence that obviously we need to defer to. But since we don't know that, we're going to continue marching along the realm of Pshuto Shel Mikra. So that's the background behind the one sentence of when are we allowed to? The answer is, Mifarshim do every single pasuk that exists in the realm of Agadah. And in the realm of Halakha, some reserve the right to disagree on the level of Pshat, even though they won't usually paskin against Chazal. That's a nutshell methodology behind all of that, and I turn it over to Rabbi Helfgott.
Thank you, Rabbi Angel. Thank you again to Torah Motion for this wonderful annual conference. I just want to say a couple of things. Rabbi Angel focused on the fact that in a large swath of our tradition, there was a major distinction made between Agadah, non-legal material, versus Halakha in terms of freedom of interpretation. And this goes back already to the Gaonim. Historically, the Gaonim said, when it comes to things which are halakha, there we have to accept the rabbis, not only psak halakha, how to act, but actually their interpretation of text is binding, as opposed to non-literal stuff, like how old was Isaac at the binding of Isaac? Who was, you know, the Mikoshei Sheitzim? All these kind of non-legal issues that we have kind of freedom. Whatever makes sense, we accept. Whatever doesn't make sense. This tradition continued up until the modern period. You find it in people like Rav David Tzvi Hoffman and others. They make this very sharp distinction between halakha and agadah. There were many rabbinic thinkers, other rabbinic thinkers, who didn't go into that. And I'd like to explore a little bit that side of the coin. I'd like to explore those who were much more daring and were willing to challenge classical rabbinic interpretation, even in halachic material. And I want to talk about two methodologies of approaching a text, one which I would call the more Sephardic approach and one which I would call the more Northern French approach. Okay, so for Canada, French. So, okay, a little bit. The Northern French approach might be more appealing. Maybe not in Toronto, but in other parts. Okay. So, there's one tradition which is probably rooted in Arabic exegesis and Arabic methodology of approaching the Quran and other texts, which claims that a text means one thing. A text does not speak in many voices. Don't give me this kind of post-structuralism stuff. The text speaks in one voice. And my job as an interpreter is to figure out what that text means. And I'm going to work to the best of my ability using whatever tools I have, whether it's tradition, whether it's philology, whether it's context. I have to figure out what that text means. That was the classical Arabic tradition, which affected the Jewish reading of the Bible as well within Arabic lands. And so when you take people like Maimonides, the Rambam, you take people like Ibn Ezra, you take people like Ibn Janah, and all the great Parshanim, if you really cut through the surface, they really believed in their heart of hearts that the Bible means one thing. This pasuk means when it says, "Ki kach ish isha," when a man takes a woman, I know I have to figure out what it means. And don't tell me the text speaks in many voices. That's nice for nice vortlach. But the text means one thing. Now you have a dilemma. What's the dilemma? The dilemma is what happens. You know, often, let's say 80-90% of texts, again, without getting too complicated, it's not so complicated to figure out what it means. But then, what happens when you have texts that don't necessarily mean, it's not so clear what they mean? And then, in addition to that, what happens when you have texts that seem to mean something other than what you have by received tradition of what the text, of how we live our life? Like, for example, Ukshartem la'ot al yadecha, which traditional Jews living in the Middle Ages, we're putting on tefillin, just like we do today. What do you do when your philology and your understanding of biblical grammar and context leads you in a direction that points to that the text doesn't seem to mean what it means? What do you do with that? So basically, you have a couple of strategies, exegetical strategies, as a parshan. One strategy is basically to try to shoehorn in and show that you don't understand philology and exegesis well enough, but if I can show you, and I'm going to work hard by looking at other parts of the Bible and throwing 100 proofs at you that what you think is not philology is really, yes, the rabbinic interpretation is the correct philological interpretation. So Ibn Ezra will throw you 100 proofs about ayin tachat ayin really means eye for an eye, really means money and not an eye for an eye. That's part of your strategy. The second part of your strategy is, so that's one thing you're going to do because you believe that a text means one thing. The second thing you're going to do is something that the Rambam and Ibn Ezra do on a number of occasions. And it's a little bit of, if you really, really research, it's a little bit of sleight of hand, if I could use that term. Once in a while, Ibn Ezra and the Rambam will do this also, will say, you know, that rabbinic interpretation is an interesting interpretation, but it's a dat yachid. It's a minority view. Like the Rambam, for example, again, I'm using as an analogy, in the world of machshava, of Jewish thought, the Rambam says, yes, there were rabbis who believed in demons, but that's a minority opinion. You think the Rambam sat there and counted up every single Amora, whether they believed in demons or not? I bet you good historians could figure out that probably most Amoraim believed in demons. It was not a minority opinion. But it's a strategy to, so to speak, delegitimize an opinion and say, in effect, this is not really the authentic tradition. It's an asmachta, even Ezra will say sometimes. The rabbis themselves didn't really believe that this is the source of the law. The source of the law is an authentic tradition, Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. But that they weren't claiming that that's the meaning of the text. That's a second strategy that you do. And the third strategy, you understand, what you've done is you've constricted and you've basically said, the text means one thing. There are times when we do other things in the way that we practice our religion, but the text is not really the source. The source is a tradition, halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, or something else. The text really means something else. And the third strategy is ala the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvot, in the second Shoresh, where the Rambam basically constricts what actually, what we call Torah Sheba'al Peh. You know, we use the word, you know, or in some schools they call it Toshba, Torah Sheba'al Peh, to include the whole corpus of the Talmud. But for the Rambam, Torah Sheba'al Peh is a very limited part. There's five categories of law, as the Rambam writes in the introduction to the Mishnah. But what we, Torah Sheba'al Peh is the exact definition of a certain part of the law. For example, the Torah says, take Pri Eitz Hadar. Pri Eitz Hadar, we, by transmission, God said, means an etrog. That's a definitional issue. The Rambam also says, Halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai is also part of Torah Sheba'al Peh. But the vast majority of what we call Jewish law, where you have debate in the rabbis, what's the source of this? That, the Rambam says, is not Pshuto Shel Mikra. That is an accretion onto the text. The rabbis were given the authority to darshan text through the 13 principles of exegesis. But that's not what the text means. That, the Rambam used an interesting analogy in his Hakdamah, in the second Shoresh to the Sefer Mitzvot. He says it's kimo anaf uperot. It's like the leaves and the fruit that come from the branch of a tree. It's an interesting analogy. It means it's not there itself, but it is there in potential to be learned out from the text. But that's not what the text itself means. So that's Maimonides and Ibn Ezra and the Sephardic tradition, which basically says, fundamentally, the text means one thing. And therefore, very often it will mean what the rabbis say it mean, even in halakha, and even in Agadah sometimes, but even certainly in halakha. When I have a conflict between the halakha hapsuka, the way Jews live, and what I see in the text, so I have three methods. Either I'll say, the text means what the rabbis say, I'm going to have to shoehorn and work really hard in my philology. The second approach is, that halakha is not really based on this text, and the text means something else. Number three, I'm going to go and say that it's not in the text, it's derivative of the text. That's the Sfaradim, in a nutshell. But there was an Ashkenazic tradition that culminated in Rashbam, which said that the Bible is multivocal, multivalent, which is a much more radical reading, which said, as Rabbi Angel hinted at, that at the same time that the Torah says X, but X can mean Y or Z, because if you approach the Bible with different methodological tools, if you approach it with the Darkei Hadrash, you're going to end up in one place. And if you approach it with the methodology of the Peshat, you're going to end up in another place. And the Bible at the same time is saying, don't ask me which is right and which is wrong. You're asking the wrong question. Both of them are equally right at the same time. And the classic verse that they quote is the verse in Mishlei or Tehillim, tell me if I'm good. Achat diber Elokim, shtayim zu shamati. It's in Tehillim. God spoke once, but two things I heard, and they're both equally legitimate. Okay, it's not that one is more legit. They're both true in kind of alternate universes at the same time. The text means two things, even contradictory at the same time. That's what the Rashbam says. And therefore, the text can mean different things. And I don't have to get into all kinds of dreidlach that I'll force the philology to fit in with Chazal. No! Chazal were using a different methodology. At the same time, there's different methodologies that teach me. The Bible is a divine work, believed Rashbam. And therefore, it can convey many things which are equally true on different levels. Halakha is based on the methodology of Drash, and Pshat is based on a different methodology.
Okay, thank you.
Rabbi Helfgott, Rabbi Angel, and I'm glad to participate in this discussion, and thank you for the Torah in Motion for inviting me here to Toronto. Okay, I'll be very brief in my remarks. I'm not going to go into the, as Rabbi Helfgott, Rabbi Angel referenced, some of the background in terms of how exegetes have dealt with this question. I would say that, speaking for myself, I would be firmly in Rabbi Helfgott's second camp in seeing the Bible as having many voices. I think in the last 100 years, certainly the last 50 years, there's been enormous discussion in general, not just about the Bible, about how texts express their meaning. For example, I'll give an example. Recently it came to my attention that someone had written an article about the following question. Why does Joseph, who's in Egypt, viceroy of Egypt, not write a letter to his father that he's okay? That's the formulation of the question that I had heard. And then I didn't see the article. I was told over the article, so I can't give a certain answer, which I don't accept the answer. But before not accepting the answer, I think we have to ask whether we accept the question. The Ramban asked this question, but is that actually a question? In other words, when you read a text, do you ask why something is missing from a text? Certainly when we read novels, we don't ask those questions. So what is this? How do we read the Torah? Is the Torah essentially a literary work, which may or may not have a historical basis? But at the end, even if it does have a historical basis, it's a literary work. And in literary works, we typically don't simply ask why something's not there, except when the text itself suggests such a question. And my point is that what's happening, I think what continues to happen, and hopefully will continue to happen over time, is that we gain some insight, actually, about how one approaches texts. The medievals had a certain conception about how a text works. I think in the last 50 or 100 years, the Western world has produced various people who deal with precisely this question. We have questions of ambiguity in the text. And there are really two kinds of ambiguity in the text. Sometimes it's ambiguous because the Torah, for example, doesn't want to let us know. Esav is approaching Jacob with 400 men. What is his motive? Jacob thinks the worst, prepares for the worst, but the reader asks the question, what actually is Esav thinking? Afterwards, they make peace, they seem to get along just great. Is that because Jacob mollifies him, or is that because he never intended it in the first place? And we don't know. That's one kind of ambiguity. Second kind of ambiguity, though, is different. It reminds me of what Rabbi Soloveitchik spoke about. He was very fond of quoting the Ritva in Masechet Erevin. The suffix of Bein HaShemashos, twilight. Twilight is a suffix. The way we normally think of it, a doubt. Is it day or is it night? And the point of the Ritva is, it's not a doubt because it's either day or night. It's a doubt because it's both day and night. And in reading biblical text, that's a very important point. Because what happens, the way biblical narrative works, certainly, and I think it could be extended even to some of the halakhic texts, one text recalls another. But by the time you get to a string of texts, you're recalling 10 different texts and hearing 10 different voices, many of which contradict the other. And then the suffix, the doubt, emerges not because we have too little knowledge, but in a sense, because we have too much knowledge. So to me, the question is, clearly, I believe that we seek truth wherever we can find it. I think we start with our own tradition. I think the question is not so much an academic question for us as it is a kind of educational question. I think we're dealing, let's say, with children. I don't think you bring in the documentary hypothesis to second grade. I don't believe it. Because I believe education means you have a base. Everybody in this world needs a place, and we need a place from which to begin. But I don't think you teach the six-year-old the way you teach the 26-year-old. Unfortunately, my experience has been that in many places, no distinction is made between the way a 26-year-old reads the Bible and the kinds of questions that the 26-year-old should be asking and should be addressing, and the way we teach our children. So I think it's an educational issue about how to create an educational program which allows people to have a strong sense of rootedness in their tradition, but which also allows and encourages, maybe even demands all of us to seek truth wherever it comes from. And I'll make one last point about seeking truth wherever it comes from. You know, I'm right now I'm working on the Megillat Esther. started working on it. So the first thing I do is open up the Megillah and read it. A few days before Purim, it's a good idea for everybody to read it. And you read the last chapter of the Megillah, which describes how the holiday of Purim emerges. And when you read that chapter, without preconceptions, it is pretty clear to me that Purim, as Mordechai sets it up, is a two-day holiday. Not one day for one group and one day for another group. And if you don't believe me, go back and read it yourselves. It's clear to me that Mordechai tells all Jews to keep 2 days, sort of akin to Passover. There's the 14th of Nisan, and there's the 15th of Nisan. And when you read it, it's pretty clear. I would say not 100%, 90% clear. Which the importance of that is the following, and this is a very important point for me, which is then imperative to go back to our tradition and to figure out, and precisely if that's not what the text says, to try to understand why the rabbis constructed a certain way. And that enhances not just our understanding of our written tradition, but the point is, the key point is, it pays proper respect and allows us a profound understanding of what we call Torah Sheba'al Peh. And the attempt to read into the written word, all of Torah Sheba'al Peh, to sort of shoehorn it in, as Rabbi Helfgott said, is a deep disservice, not just to the Bible, but a deep disservice to our tradition. I think if you have true emunat chachamim, if you really believe that those who came before us had what to teach us, and could read the text as well as we can, we do have some new tools they didn't have, of archaeology, some linguistic tools, but there are great people who have come before us. If we respect them, then it behooves us to try to understand, given that the text says X, why did they take it a different way? What was their thinking? What was their educational program? So I think it all begins with the text. I like to study initially without any commentaries, just to see what I think it says, and to see how the great ones who came before us understood it, how my colleagues understand it, to seek truth in all places. And I'll just add with one little story. Many years ago when I started Drisha, which was a place where women could study Torah, access to all the texts, I started a Kollel for women in 1984, by the way. Yes, I am crazy, I know that. But 1984, we had a Kollel. Someone said to me, oh, the women, it's about Kavod HaBrios, it's about honoring all of God's beings. I said, no, that's not why I do it. It's about Kavod HaTorah. It's honoring the Torah. The more people you bring to the study of Torah, the more voices we hear, the better we can understand. So we start with our own tradition, we root ourselves in the tradition, and when we open ourselves to all those who can teach us, we seek truth in all places. Thank you.
Okay, I actually had a set question, but I'm going to change that. I'd like to talk about something that you began with, Rabbi Silber, and take a little issue with it. You were talking about the question that you read about Joseph contacting his father, and whether if something is missing from the text, whether that should be a question. So I taught English literature for several years, and one of the things you see is whether something is a question depends on the reader's investment in the text as a guide to life. So, in other words, if you say you're making comparison to literature, if somebody doesn't ask something in Dickens or Hardy, the question would be whether the person is invested in that missing question because they are so bound up with what happens to David Copperfield or to Jude the Obscure that they really it's important to them to know what this person would do because they're thinking about it in terms of their life. What we want from our characters is contingent on how much of a signpost they are for their lives. So I think actually the missing question does make a difference. And I think there is a difference between the two domains you talk about. And I actually am wondering now, connecting that to the whole issue of how we use the word chazal, because we seem to use that in a very monolithic way, as if it's one block of people with one set of attitudes. And I want to talk pedagogically and ask you a question, all of you.
Can I respond?
Yeah,
to
sure.
The first point, I want to clarify what I said. I didn't say the question is not an important question to ask. If it's important to a student, I think it should be addressed. But my point is that I don't think that particular question, first of all, in general, when someone asks you a question as a teacher, what you try to figure out is, what are they really asking? That's the question. What's the real question here? Sometimes the question is a very clumsily phrased question. It's about something else. But they're really asking something very different. And the trick is to identify the question. My point about that verse was, I can rephrase the question. That is a good question. I can read, Joseph says, he names his oldest son Menashe, for he said, God has enabled me to forget my father's house and my suffering. Question, why did Joseph mention his whole father's house? Why does he want to forget the whole father's house? He could have said, my brothers. He could have said many things. Why does he include the father and all that he wishes to forget? That's a fair question, because the text invites the question. But in the classroom, the questions that are being raised are not just about the text. The text often is the starting point, but if someone is invested in a particular question, that as a teacher, obviously, you drop your lesson plan and you go with it, with the students, ask the question. But I wouldn't say that why Joseph didn't write to his father. My point is there could be 100 answers to that question. Maybe the post office was on strike for 6 years. I mean, the fact of the matter is, that to me is an invalid question. I know the Ramban puts it in similar terms. Nonetheless, from where I'm, how I understand the way texts work, that's my point. But I would not say that the point that you're making about what's valid for a student must be addressed in any case. But part of the teacher's role in teaching a text is to try to demonstrate how these things work. That's my only point. Not to invalidate the question.
Right. I hear that. I actually don't hear that, but I hear that. Because you're making a dichotomy between what you consider a valid, quote, textual question, unquote, and a valid, quote, educational question. Well, if we had more time. The dichotomy that you raised about halakha versus agadah, so I'm interested in this more from the empirical side of how a student or an adult, anybody learning Torah, experiences the idea of Chazal's authority. So the split that's being made here is that Agadah is either not binding or it's metaphorized. And my question to you all is whether this attitude really solves the problem. In other words, once you say that a statement by the sages can be either discarded or is not a good reading, can be disagreed with, does it in fact begin to undermine their overall status? The argument is based on a very neat split that human beings will make, that they're wrong here, but they're binding here. And I wonder on a human level if it doesn't begin to creep into people's minds, that authority begins to get undermined. And undermined here, I mean halakhically as well. So if we say that we don't know about this or that, like Chazal didn't know, let's say, about this scientific thing or this gender thing, can we create such a clean, walled-off split with their halakhic authority?
Well, since I raised this whole problem, so I'll go for it. The answer is yes. I certainly think it's possible to teach this in a very healthy manner, and it's also possible to teach this in a very unhealthy manner. I think the sound just got better as I spoke. That's a good sign. So the main issue at hand is what words you use. If you talk about discarding Chazal, okay, so that's already irreverent, and I think that a word like discarding is going to create problems in the classroom, right? If you talk about in terms of when Rashi and Rashbam disagree with one another and pose alternate readings that each one finds more likely or less likely, you can say that they're having a machloket l'shem shamayim, or you can say that Rashi would discard Rashbam and Rashbam would discard Rashi. You're saying the same thing, but obviously coming across with a very, very different point of view. And I prefer the machloket l'shem shamayim. Everybody's trying to ascertain truth, which brings me to the main dichotomy between halakha and agadah and why they are different in the rule books. Agadah works in the realm of emet v'sheker. Something is true or something is not true. If it's true, it doesn't really matter who said it. And if it's not true, it doesn't matter who said it either. We want to end up with the truth. As a result, there's no binding authority system because there can't be. Everybody who's reading the Torah must be able to read the Torah, and then you have to bring proof texts and argumentation and how you approach the text. There are so many different methodological issues that come into play, and all of them are relevant. In the realm of halakha, at least halakha lemaaseh, we're dealing with a totally different domain of isur v'heter. There are certain things that we must do, they're mitzvah. There are certain things that we may do, rishut, and there are certain things that we must not do, isur. So poskim will debate the binding status of them, but we need to have some system of authority in the realm of isur v'heter for a very practical reason. If we're all sitting around the Shabbat table, We can disagree with Parshat HaShavua all we want, and we can even get heated if we want it, right? And we can go for it, and we can walk out more aggravated than we ever were before we started the chalent. But the chalent better be kosher and Shabbat friendly, or we can't even sit around the table. The binding system of halakha requires at least, I mean, there's plenty of diversity within halakhic interpretation and observance, but in principle, halakha is there to bring us together as a common observant community. And then the realm of intellectual truth, obviously, we don't need to agree in order to be able to sit around the same table. That's an oversimplification of the issue, but it's one that indicates that if one, the fact that Rashbam thinks that the Isha Kushit is a different woman hardly is going to undermine the halachic system or even one's respect for Chazal. He's simply saying, I think the Pasuk reads something different from the way many Midrashim that identify the Isha Kushit with Tziporah reads. And that's it. I don't see that as causing any irreverence, but quite to the contrary, it teaches reverence for the Torah, which is that ultimately it is a pursuit of truth, and it teaches reverence for halakha and chazal in that realm, because ultimately we accept their binding authority, and that's how we survive as an observant community.
Maybe later.
So that's definitely not it. That doesn't end the matter, because classrooms are not neat places. Classrooms are not places where you can say this kind of thing, that, you know, so-and-so didn't agree with that and so-and-so didn't agree with that. And you have all sorts of things where the actual position of Chazal seem strange or even wrong or at even times ludicrous to a modern sensibility. And except if you have an extremely committed populace a priori, it is going to creep in and it is going to seep through that clean split. So because classrooms are not neat places, I'm still wondering how we address that question of once authority gets undermined. In other words, in Haredi education, which in many ways is not a system that many of us might advocate, but the consistency of trying to sort of ram home a complete authoritative system across the board of everything that Chazal say has a certain logical consistency. It's hard to uphold on some level, but one can see that they are trying to seal off any cracks in the wall across the board. We have it tougher, I think, in a more sort of modern outlook. So I'm wondering if anybody would like to address that.
Rabbi Silver.
Don't get us started.
Look, I think the question, let me rephrase the question. If one believes, as the Rashbam did, that the written Torah says X, and that the rabbinic understanding is based on a different reading, which is not what the Torah's Heath believes seems to be saying. And the question is, what is the source of the authority of those people? If it's not the word of the Torah, then what is their source of authority? And let me just say the following, that leaving education aside, and having spent a fair amount of my time studying Talmud or whatever, I would make the following argument, that I don't think that the issue is what the text actually says. I don't think that the problems that the Jewish community faces, whether it's the centrist, orthodox, or whatever, is a function of what the text says. It doesn't matter what the text says. At the end of the day, whether it's Judaism or Islam or Christianity or whatever, it's not about what the text says. It's who is interpreting the text. That's the issue. When you don't have a group of people interpreting, we live by the Torah Shel Baal Peh, the ongoing interpretation. Whatever the rabbis thought of their own interpretation, I'm fully convinced that they often knew that's not what the text actually says. They're using the text to make a different point. Their authority is coming from a different place. And the answer to our problems is to get a bunch of people together who are steeped in their tradition, but who also have living in our century is obvious, but also really understanding and be able to pick up on all the positive things, the positive values that the world has to offer, somehow integrating that or synthesizing it with the values that are deep within our own tradition, trying to work it out. Good people will disagree, but to move the project forward. I don't think it matters one hoot what the text actually says, to be perfectly blunt about it.
What did you mean by the answer to our problems?
The problem of how you live in our problems? I'll speak for my problems.
Okay.
Which is, speak for myself, you identify, it's good, but my problem is deeply connected to a tradition not just of theoretical thinking, but of practice. Many of those practices don't align with my own deepest moral beliefs. And I can give many examples of that. I'm a fully egalitarian person. I don't believe there should be any distinction between men and women in terms of opportunity. The practice of the community that I most identify with doesn't function that way. It functions in a different way. For me, that's a problem. And there are many other problems. I can loads of problems. And the question is not how do I deal with it, but moving the project forward, are there people who feel in a similar way, who are deeply committed to the tradition, but who also want to find solutions? If you don't think there's a problem, by the way, you never find a solution. Any issue you're going to raise, can women read the Megillah, which is a simple answer. If you don't really think it's important, you'll find 50 reasons they can't, okay? So the point is, find the 10 people who think they should, because it's a moral imperative. Then you begin to find solutions. You wrestle and you struggle, but you find some answers. You begin to deal with the reality of who we authentically are.
I want to get back to the educational issue. I think it's a real dilemma, but you can't hide your head in the sand. I don't think we've tasted from the forbidden fruit already. We're not Haredim, and there's too much issues for most of us, and I think we believe in truth, balancing that with commitment. And I think that the goal, everything has to be developmentally appropriate. That's the key. And that requires skill. And as Rabbi Angel said, nomenclature is important, but also pedagogical thinking about how you do it. So with a six-year-old, you can teach. You don't teach them, you know, the Rashbam, the idea of multiple levels of truth is very hard for a six-year-old to accept. But you can begin to get them into the habit of recognizing what's in the text and what's not in the text. That is a simple pedagogical thing which I do with my children, my 6 and 7 year olds. I'm not talking about what's truth and what's not truth yet. Simply, your Mora told you something in class, just show me, is it in the text or not? And that's it. You don't get a value judgment yet. As the kid progresses, then you can get into higher levels thinking skills about, okay, what does it say in the text? What was the problem the rabbis had in the text that may have caused the Midrash to offer this solution to this problem? As they get older, you start to evaluate. Does it make sense? Does it not make sense? In the text, in the sense of, from an exegetical point of view, are there 10 proofs for one side, 10 proofs for another? Once they get into high school, I think you treat kids with respect, intellectual respect, that you start to put on the table. You start to maybe shatter some myths. You start to shatter some of the notions, some of the superficial notions about the idea that there can't be multiple truths. There can be multiple truths in an ambiguous text. And a text, depending on which speaks to you more, the Rashbam's approach, the Rambam's approach, you do things developmentally. You create a safe space of Yirat Shamayim, but intellectual honesty. And you push, yes, but that's the way that you do it, developmentally, educationally, pedagogically.
Can you tell me, you're talking about shattering a myth, quote-unquote, in high school. Can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
No, the idea, the myth that, let's say, that they're, I use a strong term, but the idea that one is forced to accept that there was a gigantic, you know, frog that looked like one of the Thanksgiving floats. And that, you know, with the Tzvardeya, and that if you don't accept that, that somehow you're not a good Jew, or you're not a frum Jew, and that you somehow are undermining the system, that you can, without talking about, without making fun, or saying Chazal here are silly, but to talk with integrity and say, Chazal are saying something serious here about how they read a text. They're trying to convey a message. Let's try to unpack the message while not necessarily accepting it as pshuto shel mikra. So that's what I'm talking about. If you want to use a shattering myth.
I just wanted to chime in one thing, you know, to talk about how the classroom is a complicated place. I couldn't agree more. I think that that's why we spend lifetimes and we haven't solved all the problems yet. But the one point, Elliot, that I couldn't disagree with your premise more is this answerability to a coherent Haredi system, which I think is unfair to the Haredim, honestly, in terms of this caricature of how, you know, all Haredim may or may not think. The biggest issue in play is, yes, it's hard to teach Pshat and Drash, and yes, it's hard to teach multivalence, but those things are true. not teaching those is a lie to our tradition. A good example of that, regardless of whether one is modern Orthodox Haredi, I don't care about these labels, they don't mean anything to me, but one who shuts down these discussions is lying to our tradition. A good example of this is once I took on a 10-way machloket over a certain pasuk in whatever sefer we were doing, and after this whole long analysis, Rashi, I thought, had the most likely reading, so that was great. So one student, quote unquote, from your stereotypical took massive umbrage at me. Why? Sided with Rashi, right? He said, why did you waste our time? Rashi's always right. So this was fun. So I'm like, okay, you're toast. But what do you do here? You go to Bar Ilan Sidi Ram and you search Ramban where you look for Rashi and Ze'eino Nachon. And you print up hundreds of references where Ramban does that. So I come back to my student and say, you have two options here. Either say Ramban is a heretic, or admit that your methodology is false. And so he backed down and went to graduate school in Jewish studies, actually. It changed his whole orientation because he realized that this bizarro oversimplification where, you know, Chazal this, Chazal that, is simply a lie to our tradition. It's not an issue of what's coherent or not coherent. If you want to never look at Tanakh and Mefarshim, good, you'll be coherent, but you're also not looking at Tanakh and Mefarshim. So I find that position wrong.
I wasn't talking about multivalence. I was talking about the issue of authority and how authority is treated in the different school systems.
No, I agree, but I'm saying if Rashi becomes that authority representing the world of Midrash, it's undermining our tradition, is what I'm trying to say.
But it is true, Elliot, and I don't think we should shy away from that we do in the modern Orthodox community have a different attitude to authority. And yes, we can accept the notion, some people can't, but we accept the notion that Chazal can be wrong in science and may have worked off the science of the day, and yet we work off of a legal tradition. I don't want to say we're legal positivists, but we work off of a legal tradition that gives authority to precedent and to tradition and to those things, while recognizing that it may not necessarily be absolute truth. But that's the Gemara. The Gemara, you know, Rabbi Angel talks about lying to our tradition. The Gemara says, you know, there's a machlokas, where it's in Bava Metzia, Peches or somewhere. The Gemara says there's a machlokas between Rava Bar Nachmeni and somebody else. About a Baharis Kodom Lolavan or Lavan Kodom Baharis, when it comes to Tzarat, what's the psak? In a certain detail of Jewish law. And the Gemara says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says one way, and Pamal Yishomalis is another way, God Paskins one way, but we follow Rabba Bar Nachmeni to Hu Yachid Ba'ohalo, Spinagoim or something, because he is an expert. What does that mean? It means that it's not about absolute truth, it's about recognizing that they went through an authentic methodology with integrity, they came to certain conclusions, and it may be that the way we paskin may be wrong anyway, because we follow Roe, we follow all these kinds of legal things. We all know that majority may not be absolute truth, but we accept certain ways of we live our life based on practice if we buy into the system. Now, at the same time, that does mean that we don't have to play the game and say, you know, Rashi is Baruch HaKodesh, or Rabbi Bar Nachmeni is Baruch HaKodesh. We can recognize that we are accepting the authority, but what that means is that, therefore, there are limits to authority. And that also means is that there are cutoffs. The authority that Rava and Abaye have upon us is different than the authority that the Rambam has upon us, which is different than the authority that the Abarbanel has, which is different than the authority that Natty Helfgott has, meaning that yes, there are different stages of authority, and a lot of it is, especially in our world of choice, is choosing to accept upon ourselves certain things. And yeah, sorry, I talked enough.
I'm going to ask one more. I'd like to open up to the floor. I want each of you to talk about a certain methodology about when Chazal say insert dialogue in biblical characters' mouths. I've always been curious about this, like Midrashim about the Akedah, let's say. I'm wondering where, in the text, Avram is a fairly mute character, right? And that's always kind of been on people's minds. He doesn't argue, he doesn't protest, he doesn't say anything. And in the Midrash, he turns into a much more nuanced, even anguished kind of character. Is this Chazal's way of saying that they think that Avram must have had this inner struggle, even if the text shows no such thing? And if that's true, does it bother them that he doesn't have this struggle? In other words, is he Is he not who they want him to be? And therefore, is he? Are they unhappy with his sort of non-hesitant compliance?
Why don't you? Where someone can start this time.
I think your point is well taken, that the text is very laconic. The text doesn't say much about its characters. The text doesn't psychologize its characters for the most part. That's very mimesis. Eric Orbach noted this point, and it's clear. I think what the Midrash is doing, and for example, Meir Sternberg, who's written about the poetics of a biblical narrative, he very much doesn't like the Midrash. He says, what do you... The text is leaving it blank. What are you filling in the blanks for? But my view is that the blanks are being filled in, that I think as a teacher and as a student, I always ask the question, what are they seeing in the story? Now, Abraham doesn't speak too much. That's not to say that there aren't hints within the text, either this text or other texts, which suggest to us what he might have been thinking. And what I mentioned before about the stuff that's up, what the musician is hearing just below the surface. There are all kinds of voices below the surface. I prefer to see it as the Midrash is hearing some of that and making suggestions, but I always bring it back to the text. I don't think that it's coming apart from the text. I think in studying the text, we look at, the great texts have many voices. I would add to that one other point about text, which I think is very important about, decisions that are being made in the community, halacha and other kinds of decisions. I don't believe that, for the most part, they come directly from the text. I think they come from other places. I think that the Haredi community is a very good community to study. I'm not big on bashing Haredim, by the way. I think you learn from everybody, and there's some great things in that community. And we have to figure out what they're doing right. There is, number one, community in a lot of these places, real community, which is very important. And it's also about tradition. It's not, but the text says otherwise. You can show up, but we don't do it that way. We're a traditional community. So they themselves, I think, are essentially agreeing that it's about, we have behaved in a certain way over time. That's the way our leaders see us going. And it's interesting to see what actually is driving them, but that's a separate question. As far as the text is concerned, just to get back to it, I think it speaks with many voices. I think we sell these texts short. They're great texts. And I think the genius of the Midrash is hearing a lot of things. I think our obligation as students and teachers is to try to figure out what they're saying. And since you mentioned the Akedah, I will say the following. Rabbi Angel to my left is the rabbi of the Sherit...
Israel.
Sherit Israel, Spanish and Portuguese, a Sephardic synagogue. If you see the Sephardic... poems that are written about the Akedah, okay, the Nek Advam is great. I mean, they have great poets. But Abraham is not always just marching to do God's will. Abraham, in some of these, in one of the poems, Isaac says to his father, what are you going to say to mommy? I remember it's one of the, before he blew the shofar. What are you going to tell mommy, he says. Now, the Ashkenazim, because of their historical circumstance, they're being martyred all the time, so they see it as natural. So I think these different communities, different faith communities, obviously we bring ourselves to the text as well. That's a very important point. There's not some, we say you should be objective about the truth. But you can't be fully objective about the truth if you bring your person to it. We try to be objective, but we're all covered by our own experiences. I think that's a very important point we should recognize, at least in the study of text. We're covered by our experience, and all who came before us were covered by their experience.
I would just want to add to what Rabbi Silver said. I always talk about exegesis and Midrash as a spectrum. There's a whole spectrum. You know, your question asks as if there's like one answer, and I think that the reality is that the rabbis saw this text, number one, and they speak about this. You know, Komai de Efshal Midrash Darshinan. The Gemara says that anything that we can, meaning they believed it was a divine text that was latent and pregnant with all kinds of riches. It was an unassailable and unending source to teach about life and ideas, etc. So number one, I think that was the starting point of how they viewed the text. Number two, they also, there are sometimes when they're purely dealing with exegetical issues, meaning they see an anomaly in the text, which maybe you and I don't see, or because they have a heightened sense of certain things, and that's what draws them to suggestion. Number three, sometimes, and this is something that we've become more sensitive to today,
They read one story in light of many other stories in the Bible. And therefore, they either of that same character, and therefore will retroject into a story elements of the later Abraham into the earlier Abraham, elements of the later Moses. Number three. Number four, as Rabbi Silber said, they came to the text with their cultural, religious, political assumptions, and therefore they read biblical figures in that way. And number five, just like rabbis today, and this is the spectrum, meaning you start from pure exegesis to reading the Bible in its totality and characters and so on. Number three, issues of subjective, political. And number five, sometimes the rabbis, just like rabbis today, open up the Medrash Rabbah. It says, you know, Patach, you know, he began, they're giving sermons. And the Bible is an or text, a springboard to give Musar to the people who is in front of them, to teach them, to give them hope. To give them, and that's also part of our tradition. I mean, when, for example, I mean, I always, when we, you know, the best example is when the rabbis, you know, it says at the beginning of Exodus, a very beautiful verse, actually, a verse which is actually positive on a pshat level. It says, and the Jews, paru vayishritzu vayirbu me'od me'od. It has creation language. The Jews are vatimalei ha'aretz otam. The Jews are everywhere. It's very rich. Beautiful. The rabbis read it very negative. Once some of the rabbis, they said, what does it mean vatimalei ha'aretz otam? They were in the kirkaot and the teatrot. That they went to the theaters and the circuses. Now, you don't have to be a big biblical scholar to know there were no theaters and no circuses in ancient Egypt. Okay? But there were theaters and there were circuses in ancient Rome. And the rabbis here are giving Musar to the people in front of them, but using this text as a springboard. So there's a whole range of things that are going on in Midrash.
Are there any questions that people want to ask from the floor? If so, you should line up behind the microphone and ask them.
Is it on? Yeah. Okay, so I have a question about the answer. Not so much a question, because it seems to me that the people who can ask questions are those who either have a history of tradition behind them or have background, who have education behind them. Now, we have a huge, huge amount of Jews who are coming back to Jewish practice who don't have educational backgrounds, don't have a history of tradition, and I'm wondering how much can they rely on their self-judgment to find an answer to seeming contradictions, or when there are different opinions, or when different people come to the text with their own interpretation based on their coming from. I'm wondering where does the individual, the person on the street, come to rely on his own or her own judgment in terms of practice?
Well, those are two different questions. Practice or interpretation?
Practice. I'm always interested in practice. Yeah, okay. What good is interpretation if you can't practice?
What do you mean? I like ideas. I like math and stuff. I don't practice math.
But personally, I believe the answer is they choose dogma, and perhaps the Haredi approach is the only kind of comforting, easy approach to do. It's like, well, they told us to, we're going to do it. But at the end of the day, that's not really the Jewish faith. As Rabbi Helfgott said, we teach people to ask questions. That's the goal, to give them that faith so they're able to ask the question.
You're asking two different kinds of questions, though. One question is talking about the person's right to engage with text and interpret it, which is a very different question than saying how does a person rely on their own judgment halakhically, which is a much different question entirely. I think that, you know, the first question is one I think you're all prepared to answer. The second one I think is really a very different domain.
I'll say my piece and then very quickly. I think that a person has to come to text with a certain amount of humility and reverence, as Rabbi Angel said, but that has to be coupled as well with a certain amount of intellectual honesty. Meaning, I'm very much a believer, like the rabbis say, that we want the Torah to become Torah delay. You want it to become the Torah of the person. You want to be invested in it. And to say to someone, read the text, but don't think about it, and don't think how it speaks to you, is, I think, not a viable option. I believe that we want people to read the text with their own intuitions, with their own person, etc. But that should also be coupled with a lot of humility. And that is that, you know what? There's a lot of very smart people before me that have read this text. And it behooves me to become much more proficient in learning that material, thinking about that material, digesting that material, and getting my skills. So I think that it's a combination of approaching the text. You know, I've taught over the years people who have very little background in the Wexner Foundation and here, and yet they had wonderful things to say when we were reading a text. On the other hand, they didn't have the background to say everything, but everybody has something to contribute with humility, understanding what your limits are, etc. In terms of praxis, the same thing. A person needs to know their limits and not their limits. And that goes to rabbis as well. There's a difference. I'm an ordained rabbi. If somebody asks me a question today about what kind of chewing gum they can, you know, eat, or if they have to say Yalla V'Yavo, if they forgot it on Rosh Chodesh, I think I'm able to answer that question. I think I have enough training. But if you at the same time ask me about pulling the plug on somebody who's dying in a hospital, I think that humility would say I should consult with somebody else a little bit more experience, a little bit broader shoulders than I. So it's a question of the same thing for the individual. Things that a person knows about and understands, they should paskin for themselves. You don't have to run to a rabbi for every things. Things that are beyond your pay grade, talk to somebody who, you know, is a little bit above you.
I would just add one brief word, which is I would say to that person, I agree with everything Rabbi Helfgott said, but in addition, the key is to start learning yourself. That person, the key is to put yourself in a position where you are a learner. I don't mean you personally, but whoever this person is, all of us, because learning is a lifetime experience for everybody, but it's very important to recognize, the Ramban, it's like saying, I disagree with Einstein. You disagree with Einstein? Yeah, I took a course in physics, I disagree with Einstein. I mean, the Ramban is a giant. Now, the Ramban, in every page, 10 people disagree with him. Also giants. It doesn't mean we have to be silent, we can't think for ourselves, but we approach it by, we are entering into the discourse of great people, but it's an obligation to try to figure it out for ourselves as well. And I think the most important point is that everybody should try to find a place that they feel speaks to their heart, and where they can begin to learn and continue to learn and move forward.
Let's take one more just before that. Margaret Atwood's true story. She was at a party and she introduced herself, and the guy said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I write novels." And she said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm a neurosurgeon." And he said, "But you know, I was thinking after I retire that I'm going to start writing novels." And she answered, "Really? Because after I retire, I would try my hand at neurosurgery." anyway, go ahead.
I just said one last question. It's a little bit tangent to what we've been discussing so far, but when we disagree with Chazal, don't we have to disagree on their terms? Don't we have to do it in a Hebrew environment? I think we've been kind of led astray by all these great English translations, which are not really the reality of you know, what we're talking about. I mean, it's a nice background or simplification or whatever, but all of these discussions are predicated on a person understanding two or three levels of Hebrew, and I want to say the most...
Why Hebrew? Aramaic.
Well, let's just go with the Hebrew for
Galilean
now.
Language.
And Hebrew is actually a changing language as we speak. In Israel, the words are not meaning the same things as they meant to Chazal. So how can we disagree with them when we are working with, you know, a changing vocabulary?
I don't even know how to answer that. In the nutshell version is, of course, you're at a disadvantage if you're studying a text and not the original language, and not just studying it in the original language, but actually knowing that language really, really well to understand to the best that we can, what does the Bible mean, what does the Talmud mean, and so on and so forth. So yes, when people disagree, sometimes those disagreements are based on a watered-down understanding of the original text rather than a level playing field. So you're right. So there's a disadvantage. And likewise, if somebody reads the Bible in English, says, "Well, I disagree with Rashi because da 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 da," maybe it's because the translator took a point of view, which, funny enough, is not like Rashi. And so you don't even realize that the disagreement is rooted, you know, on the wrong level. That doesn't mean that there's no room for disagreement with the translation. People who read Archroyal Talmud or JPS Bible commentary translation of the Bible, you do the best that you can with the language skills that you have, and there's certainly room to learn. I don't think one should not learn if they can't be an expert in the original language.
Yeah, I want to thank all of our speakers and all of you for coming today.